Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Christy Rawlinson. Christy is a specialist in and lover of trees and of forests, and which is a really important thing for me because I love trees and forests, but I don't love it as a scientist, and she is a scientist. She works in the Morton Arboretum in Chicago, but we're going to find out more about her and have her educate me and hopefully all of us on the beauties of trees in Michigan. Christy Rawlinson, With Respect. Christy, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Okay, I saw you make a presentation in Chicago at the Science Fest this year for the Chicago Science Organization of some sort, and made a very interesting presentation. And I had to have you come on the show because I love trees. I don't know why. I just love them.
I think that's true for a lot of people. It's certainly, whenever people ask what I do, the first thing I say is, I study trees. I like trees. I think a lot of people resonate with that.
How did you get it? What was the thing that got you into trees and as a career?
I grew up in the Appalachians. My county is almost entirely national forest. The main employer of the region is a paper company. And mm-hmm. so trees are really at the center of life. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those places where you either grow up loving trees or hating them. And so as a kid, we ran around in through the holler and, you know, got lost, climbed trees, fell out of trees.
Break any bones?
No, not until grad school. and so I think it's just one of those things where they're just these giant dominant parts of the landscape. You know, where I grew up, the trees were bigger than any of the buildings. Mm-hmm. And they just always fascinated me. They were always there. They were always changing. And then kind of as I grew up, I realized how many different kinds of trees there mm-hmm. are. And I just wanted to know why they're different. What makes them different? Why is this one over here and that one's over there? And it was just kind of at the center of my life from the very beginning.
And did you go on a straight line on trees when you were 2 years old and you loved trees and you just went straight to deal with trees?
It kind of kept coming back to trees.
So what were the other things that you were interested in?
I started out with growing my garden. And so mm-hmm. the first thing that got me into plants in general was just, I remember, you know, going down to grandma's and picking green beans. Mm-hmm. And grandpa had a big rose garden. And so I started off, you know, when I was in, you know, elementary school, probably about third, fourth grade, like, you know, I want to grow a garden. I want to grow my plants. And then I thought, okay, well, I can be a horticulturist. I can make pretty, pretty plants. Mm-hmm. But just kind of, I always would kind of end up abandoning weeding in the garden to go run around in the woods. And kind of as I got older and got to go camping and backpacking, just the trees, I just coming back to, you know, large trees and ecosystems dominated by trees.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you say that you lived in a national forest.
Pretty much, yeah.
How did that work?
I mean,
was your family into rangers or something like that?
I am from a family of chemists and engineers.
Oh boy.
So my dad is a chemical engineer and worked at the paper mill. Mm-hmm. My mom has a degree in organic chemistry, and she mm-hmm. kind of taught in various capacities. And actually, when I went to college, I said, you know, I'm going to study trees and, you know, forests because I don't want to spend time at a microscope. And I don't want to have to learn to do computer stuff. And I kind of ended up eating those words. But even though my parents, you know, they didn't study trees, they didn't study biology or ecology, but they always had an appreciation for the woods. My mm-hmm. mom is a hippie at heart. Mm-hmm. She's always kind of like nature. And my dad, even though he's a chemical engineer and with the paper company, said there are two kinds of trees, sawtimber and pulpwood. But even given that, you know, he was very active in Boy Scouts. And so I was always taking my brothers and us camping. Mm-hmm. So even though he would kind of joke with that, he also has a deep appreciation for nature and trees.
So brothers, sisters, you had siblings?
Yeah, I have two brothers. My older brother is a robotics engineer.
Okay.
And my little brother is a math and computer science guru that actually does cybersecurity with the Army.
And now, when you saw these trees, you love trees, you love forests, you were an out-of-doors kid.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you went for trees as opposed to chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of in about eighth grade, I did this field ecology summer program. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of from then on, I was pretty sure that trees are where I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of even through college, I tried to get as much experience in other things as possible to make sure that it wasn't just kind of the default. I wasn't doing what was always there. And so I had like forays into sustainable building.
Mm-hmm.
I did one summer doing wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
But trees kind of came back as this big kind of, often we talk about them being foundational to an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if a tree is there, that really structures how the rest of nature works.
Mm-hmm.
And trees, they're big, but they're remarkably hard to study because they're so old and they're so big and they change so slowly.
Mm-hmm.
That I think many times we understand trees less than we understand other things in nature, like animals, because you can't take it into a lab and prod it.
Aha, uh-huh. That's right.
Yeah.
And you have to be at least 200 years old to really get to know them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, studying even a single tree is, you know, five or six careers.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I grew up doing many of the same things that you did, except I tried to escape being what everybody else in my family was, which was a lawyer. And I was going to go to Alaska. Even if I was going to be a lawyer, I was defaulting to Alaska because I wanted to be in the wilderness. I wanted to see, you know, be near the mountains and all glaciers. And God, I was just, my poor parents had to go through this stage where I read Alaska magazines and had them sprayed all over the house. Now, I gave in, I became a lawyer. But I always had this, I grew up in around trees. I used to swing on them, the vines, and build forts in them, and my brother and I did all this stuff. We loved the woods. And that, I call it my experiential love of trees. So that is, I just lived there, and that was my summer and my weekend pleasures. Now, but there are all different kinds of ways of looking at trees, which are not just kids swinging on vines. And you've named you've identified a few things, but before we get into parsing that out, all the different things you can be interested in trees about, you went to college. Where did you go?
I went to Oberlin College,
mm-hmm.
Northern Ohio, just outside of Cleveland.
Yes, and did you get, what degrees did you get?
I majored in both biology and environmental studies, so mm-hmm. it was a very interdisciplinary, classic liberal arts mm-hmm. education, and so, you know, my mind's always been in the science, but that made me take philosophy, economics. Environmental history is one that I end up using way more than I ever thought I would as a biologist.
Mm-hmm. So what degrees, bachelor's, master's?
Yeah, so I got my bachelor's at Oberlin, and then I went to Penn State and got both my master's and my PhD in ecology there.
Okay.
And so ecology is another interdepartmental program. So it, you know, I was housed in forestry, but other people were in biology or geography. So kind of this whole time, it's been, you can't know just trees. You have to know kind of the broader context
mm-hmm.
in which they exist. So it's, yeah.
Well, so after your PhD, what did you do?
So my master's and my PhD had all been kind of field-based. To do those degrees, I was out hiking in the woods. And so after that, I went to Boston to do a postdoc, which is kind of a two-year stint after you get your PhD, where you get a bit more training in, you learn to be a bit more independent as a scientist. But because all of my previous experiences had been field-based, you know, I never wanted to give up being that person swinging from the trees. But I knew that kind of today, especially as we're talking about climate change, we hear a lot about models and how models are used to understand what the world is going to be like 100 years from now. So I went to Boston to learn modeling and how we can represent the world through computer simulations. And then after doing that for about 2.5 years, I got the job at the Morton Arboretum, which lets me do kind of whatever I want as long as it relates to trees.
All right. Well, many of us know what the Morton Arboretum is, but for those who don't, tell us about what that is.
So the Morton Arboretum is out in the western suburbs of Chicago. It's Morton as in Morton Salt Company. It's founded by Joy Morton back almost 100 years ago. And an arboretum is basically a tree museum. We are technically an accredited museum. We've got trees from around the world growing in the suburbs of Chicago. So it's a really cool opportunity to study trees from China or trees from Colorado right next to our native trees from the Midwest. So we literally have trees from China growing next to, you know, that classic bur oak that is kind of, I think, of the characteristic tree of the Midwest. But we also have natural areas. And so it's this great opportunity to study, you know, the kind of trees you would plant in your backyard right next to trees growing as a natural forest as well.
Now, the Morton Arboretum, how does that rank around the world as far in either size or reputation or whatever?
There are only a handful of actual arboreta as big and as science-driven as we are. One thing that's kind of unique about the Morton Arboretum is that from its very beginning, there were kind of three pillars. One was conservation, one was growing new kinds of trees, and then the other was science. And that is kind of restricted to only a handful of arboreta and the larger arboreta in the world. Another thing that makes us really unique is that we aren't associated with a university at all. A lot of the other large arboretums out there, like the Arnold Arboretum in Boston, that's part of Harvard. But we are this own independent entity, which is a bit different. We are 1,700 acres of trees and a bit of prairie too. And so that's also very large compared to most arboreta and botanic gardens.
Well, you mentioned another word, which I am also interested in, which is prairie. And again, I grew up in a place where when I was in the city of Chicago, and I would go out to play, and the guys that I played with, when we told our parents where we were going to go, we said, we're going over to the prairie on 33rd or 73rd Street. And that was a common word that we used for an empty lot with weeds. And it was not exactly the classic definition of prairies that gave the Illinois the title of the prairie state. But what are prairies? Really?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one I'm still trying to learn and figure out. Most of my background is on the East Coast, where everything is or was forested. But here it's this interesting, what we call an ecotone, a boundary of forest and, you know, prairie. So it's two different ecosystems that kind of come together and meet. And so I'm still learning what a prairie is, because I kind of always, well, I spent some time out west where we have the tall grass prairie, which is, you know, completely grass dominated with a couple shrubs. But I'm learning here in Illinois, it's not just grasses. There are a lot of what we call forbs, which are basically non-grass herbaceous plants. So it's not woody. So these are a lot of your classic wildflowers, things like solidagos, goldenrods, your asters, Joe Pye weed. So I'm still learning, but I guess kind of the unifying characteristic is that they are dominated by herbaceous plants, not trees.
Okay. Now, we're going to take a break, but before, I just want to tell you right now, you used two words which are death to me, which is goldenrod. And it's that I am so allergic to that I don't have. There is mosquitoes, flies, and goldenrod, which I can do without in this world. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Kristy Rawlinson, who is a PhD in trees, works at the Morton Arboretum in Chicago, but has a fascinating history getting there. And we're going to be talking about her knowledge of trees and how they relate to each other and us. So, this is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Kristy Rawlinson, who is a doctor in trees. A tree doctor, sort of. But at any rate, we've been talking about woods and how she got interested in them. Now we're going to be talking about what she has seen around the country in her life and what we can see if we just go out outside of our house and outside of our little prairies. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Kristy, you came to the Morton Arboretum as what? What is your focus there?
So the job title is forest ecologist. The great thing about the Morton Arboretum is that everybody there loves and studies trees. But in terms of our science branch, we all kind of have our different specialties. And so as the forest ecologist, I tend to be the one that studies kind of trees in their natural habitats and how they interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And then I also do a lot of our global change research. So I tend to focus a lot on what makes trees where they are and how they are today. But I think in order to understand how things are today, we need to understand how they got there. So I focus a lot on how things have changed in the past and how that has created, you know, the forests we see today, and then how that might change in the future.
Well, here's a truism that I've heard, and I say a truism because I'm not even sure if it's true, but I've heard this repeatedly from different sources, that the eastern half of the United States has more trees now than it did when our European ancestors started coming here back in the 1500s. And they talk in terms of, well, it used to be more prairie in the Midwest, but now there's more trees for whatever reason. And I get lost in this truism and not knowing the facts. Now I want you to explain the real truth, because you just said that you study how our ecology, our tree ecology, worked and how it started.
Yeah, so if we move, not even that much further east, things were pretty much forested.
Mm-hmm.
And however, over the past 100 years or so, we do see forest cover increasing as people abandon the family farm. Mm. And so a lot of, you know, farms have been left to go to fallow and kind of converted back to natural areas. So in places like New England, there's actually been increasing forest cover. Here in the Midwest, it's a bit different because the natural state wasn't all forested.
Mm.
And the fun thing is, we know this because when people, you know, I'd say when people went to the Midwest, they hit the flatland and started laying out a grid as they started, you know, mm-hmm. And it's called, you know, the public land survey that happened in early 1800s, mid 1800s. And when they did that, they would go to, you know, every 5 mile mark and measure the closest 4 trees.
Hmm.
And from that, we know how many trees were on the landscape at the time the area was settled, so before they cut it and converted it to farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's using those records that we really know quite well, you know, where the trees were, and what kind of the balance between trees and prairie are. And so what's happened, particularly kind of since the early 1900s, is as we have increased basically suburbs in the area, we plant trees. And so actually in a lot of areas, particularly in the Chicago region, we do have more tree cover in terms of area than we think was there naturally.
Mm-hmm.
However, the challenging things are that it's a different kind of tree cover.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a lot of street trees now. And then the natural areas are not that big relative to what they were. So it's a more fragmented landscape.
Hmm.
But if we compare just kind of the greenness from what we would see today from, say, a satellite picture,
mm-hmm.
It's been called the homogenification of the area. Hmm. So you used to have this really kind of two-state system where either it was prairie or it was a fairly dense forest.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got this big gray area of yards.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sometimes called like a green smear.
Yeah, man, I can just see street trees and green smear. It sounds like it should be street thugs and and green globs or whatever.
Yeah. So actually through a lot of the Midwest, the tree cover is increasing compared to its historical state.
When I heard your presentation in Chicago, you talked about the march of trees, I guess is the best way I could describe it. I'm not sure if that was your words, but it was like there is a history built in every area where there are trees. They start with this kind and they develop into that kind. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. So it's not individual trees moving like Ents do in Lord mm-hmm. of the Rings or something like that.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know. Somebody told me I really popped their bubble the other day with that one. But we call that process succession. And so, you know, we see that with an abandoned farmland where it goes from being this kind of grassy community to eventually mm-hmm. having trees. You know, we also saw this process over the past, you know, 50,000 years as the glaciers retreated mm-hmm. and as Lake Michigan shrunk to what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And so as, you know, it goes from being a sheet of ice to what we see today, you know, first it was kind of bare ground and then come in all of these herbaceous prairie type species. And then gradually we start seeing trees pop up. But just kind of like players on a soccer field, each tree has its own role that it plays and its own special set of skills. We see different kinds of trees at different points in time. And so kind of the first trees that come into an area are ones that are fast growing and need a lot of light. And so they kind of come in and set the stage. But those tend to be trees that don't live real long. And so gradually, as those short-lived trees, you know, the ones that live fast, die young, they get replaced by other trees like oaks that grow a little bit slower.
Whoa, let's go back.
Okay.
That first round of playboys, so to speak, that is the ones that had, you know, live their life fast and then go away. What kinds would those be?
At least further south, it's a lot of things like tulip poplar.
Mm-hmm.
In some places, you might get some aspen. They grow fast, but they also tend to be cold tolerant, so I'm not quite sure about here. You also have some weird oddballs, like cedar sometimes will be the first thing that pops into an old field that's mm-hmm. abandoned. We get a lot of things that are considered junk trees by foresters, so things like black locust.
Mm-hmm.
Down south where I'm from, it tulip poplar is kind of the classic one that grows mm-hmm. straight and it grows fast.
Mm-hmm. Junk trees? You're insulting my trees? Junk trees?
If you're a forester that wants to maximize the amount of pretty wood that can make a floor. So the fast-growing trees tend to either grow really fast and really straight, or they're kind of gnarly. Because when you're the first thing to show up in a field, you get hit with everything nature throws at you. So, you know, a windstorm that comes through, you get the full force of it. You don't have, you know, a bunch of neighbors that are help buffering you from the storm, literally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to be that thing that goes into a field, you're going to try to be the first. You got to be really hardy and you might not come out real pretty.
Mm-hmm. So what are the kinds of, you mentioned wind, what other kinds of things affect what trees will start, be the first line mm-hmm. of trees, and what do they have to struggle with, or what do they love, and then as it moves on, what do we have? Do you see the process I'm asking?
Yeah.
This? What are the things that change the way we see trees?
Yeah, and so to throw a bit of science in there, we call these ecological niches. And so it's kind of, what is the specific set of characteristics of these trees? What roles do they play? So these trees that come in first, the kind of unifying characteristic is that they like high light environments. So light is often in a forest, we talk about light being the most constraining factor of what trees can be there. Because trees need light to take CO2 and turn it into growth. And so early successional trees all do well in high light environments. The flip side is high light environments often come with high heat and high stress because it's like sitting your car out in the parking lot. It's just going to kind of roast. It's getting a lot of sunlight, mm-hmm. but temperature is also going to be a real concern.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that gradually changes as, you know, trees come into an area is the nutrient environment. I don't know as much about that, but there is kind of this change that happens, and often we talk about nitrogen being a factor.
So when you talk about nutrients, you're talking about those chemicals or compounds which we survive with. Proteins and carbohydrates and starches and so on, whatever we call them, those are chemicals which are part of our body and are part of our growing process and our maintenance of health. And they can also, at the other end of the equation, be those things which cause us to get cancer or to get illnesses of various kinds. Or worst of all, I'm joking now, this is a joke, is those herbaceous little things that when you rub up against them, when you chase after your dog to come out of the woods and you run into poison ivy and poison oak and you regret it for weeks.
Yeah, so when I'm talking about nutrients, we're talking about more basic than that, because all of those annoying chemicals that it makes to make you sick or that we eat, those are all built actually inside the tree, inside of its leaves, inside of its roots. And so when I'm talking about the nutrients it gets from the soil, we're talking about the basic chemical building blocks of nitrogen or phosphorus, and really kind of in their elemental states. So sometimes, you know, they take it up through water in its roots. But all of those chemicals, all of those proteins and building blocks and things that we get energy from or we, you know, or drive us away, those are built by the tree itself.
All right. So we started off with these scrub things,
mm-hmm.
and we're moving towards a different kind of forest. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that, the next level.
Yeah. So kind of as those fast growers, as they kind of come in, they start to create shade, which moderates the environment. It's kind of like building a picnic shelter,
mm-hmm.
if you think about it. It provides a little bit of refuge for okay. new things to come up. And so often what we get after that first push are things like oaks. And so oaks are pretty darn hardy, but they need a little bit more time to grow into an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things, they do like sun, but they don't take advantage of it quite like the previous generation did.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things like oaks, they have roots that grow really deep, and so they're able to get water from below the surface. They're sometimes able to tap into groundwater, but that takes time. And so really they rely on that previous generation to kind of build them a little bit of shelter, and then just kind of by playing the long game, they're able to come in next.
And after the oaks, what do we have?
Typically, when we talk about oaks disappearing, we talk about things that are very shade tolerant. So those that do well with not that much light. And so that tends to be a lot of things like sugar maples, beeches. A lot of times we talk about, particularly in this region, a beech maple forest being the classic late successional state.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to note, though, is that disturbances will kind of reset the clock. So particularly in this region, we talk about fire a lot. And so a region isn't really going to get a lot of those maples and beeches unless it never gets burned. It never gets fire, which is true for some parts of the U.S. But particularly along this prairie forest boundary, there used to be a lot of fire. And it would kind of prevent those maples and beeches from ever coming in. And if you have a lot of fire, that's part of what would cause it to be a prairie. And so it's really kind of disturbances, including, you know, us cutting things down. But historically, fire would kind of control which community is present at a given place and time.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Christy Rawlinson, who is a PhD in trees and works at the Morton Arboretum in Chicago. We're talking about the march of generations and types of trees. And we're going to come back and talk about not just the those elements which can stop or prevent or flourish, help flourish trees, but also how the trees interrelate with each other. This is John Smetanker, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Christy Rawlinson of the Morton Arboretum. And you know, I'm twisting around the word arboretum over and over, but that time I got it right. She is a tree ecologist at the Morton Arboretum. We've been talking about trees and how they grow and how they change and their relationship with other kinds of plants, such as what we call prairies. And this is John Smetanka, and we are on With Respect. So, Christy, it sounds, I mean, you've talked about, and you're probably going to regret having said these words, but you've talked about the purpose of trees and how they get together and how they do this. And you're almost talking about they were really alive and almost human, or at least a community.
Yeah. I mean, so they definitely are alive. And actually, my specialty for studying forests is community ecology.
Okay. What is community ecology?
I think it's really fairly similar to a community of people in that, you know, you have a diversity of kinds of trees, and even two trees of the same species are individuals. There is a lot of variability. I have a colleague that once wrote a paper called "Your Tree is Weird," because trees are all individuals. You can have two red oaks next to each other, and maybe one grows really well and one is just kind of sickly. And so when we talk about forest communities, it's really how all of these different species and individuals of those species interact to create a healthy functioning forest.
How do I know whether something is a healthy functioning forest or a dying forest or, a sick ward?
Oh, that is a really good question and a really important question too. And a lot of it can depend on the yardstick you want to measure it by. Just kind of like with people, there's not necessarily one model for success. And so actually this is kind of the role of foresters and forest extension offices is helping you decide what your priorities are for a piece of land. And kind of from there, that helps you decide, you know, what is going to be your measure of healthy. A lot of times the basic yardsticks we use though are able to see regeneration. So if we go out in the forest, are we seeing seeds? Are we seeing young trees pop up? A lot of those young trees will never survive. But at least there's a potential for, let's say, your favorite tree got struck by lightning, that there's going to be something that can come up and take its place. And so in an unhealthy ecosystem, a lot of times it's characterized by having a lot of invasive species. So things like buckthorn or honeysuckle just dominate the understory. It creates this very dense layer that leaves no room for the actual trees to regenerate. And so that's kind of a classic characteristic of an unhealthy ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. So when I've heard, this is another truism I've heard, is that it's good to have a forest fire, in that it creates, it opens up the land to get regenerated. Is that actually true?
Yes, it is definitely true to some degree. It's not true everywhere. And the magnitude and frequency of that fire depends on where you are and what kind of trees you're wanting to regenerate. So oaks in general, at least the kind of anecdotal evidence we have, is that a moderate severity fire every kind of 5 to 10 years will help kill off non-oak trees, because oaks have really thick bark that help insulate them from the fire. And things like maples or beeches are a classic one. Beech has that super thin, smooth bark. It doesn't take a very severe fire to kind of burn into that and kill the tree. So using fire can help promote some species over others. The flip side is, if we think about what's going on out west right now, we have these very severe fires that are killing everything. And that's actually because we've removed fire from the ecosystem for about 50 years. And so it just kind of allowed fuel and basically a tinderbox to develop.
Mm-hmm.
So fire, it does play a very important role in allowing some species to persist. It does create opportunity for new trees to come in. Hopefully the species you're trying to manage for, but there is the potential for other species to come in as well.
One of the things that I saw recently was a documentary on PBS, and was talking about a fellow who came over years ago from Europe and became a legend in tree management, tree studies, and helped to start national forest, but rather to develop an understanding of how trees grow and how they interrelate and how we can, I hate to say make use of them, but I'll come to that in just a minute. But this fellow, whose name is escaping me right now, he sort of became the guru of tree ecologists in this country. Went back and forth from Europe around the 30s and 40s, and then came back recently and was honored, I guess before his death, for his pioneer work in this area. But that is what attracted me to the concept of, there are uses for trees other than chopping them down and putting swings on them. For kids, both of those are necessary. Both of those have great uses. I love to have. And my granddaughter has a swing that she has that her dad has put on, so she can, swing. And it's she loves it. She just screams with delight. But it now comes to my question: what are the uses that are out there besides, maybe starting with chopping them down for wood?
Yeah, so one thing that I love about having grown up in a national forest is the motto of the national forest system is the land of many uses. And so that means that, you know, they're trying to sustain healthy forests for a variety of purposes. Some are what we call extractive purposes. So that means chopping it down for, for firewood. Or going back to my dad's two kinds of trees, the saw timber and the pulpwood. So the saw timber would be, those large logs that we can then turn into beams for houses, flooring. The pulpwood is what makes your toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are those kind of extractive-based things that power one sector of our economy. But then there's the whole other kind of more experiential-based purposes of trees, or roles they play in our lives. And so these are the things like recreation.
Mm-hmm.
I personally would rather hike through a forest than a prairie in the middle of the summer, because it's cooler.
Mm-hmm.
Or the great fall color. Where I grew up in the Appalachians, our economy is really transitioning from that extraction-based industry into tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also just this very emotional and kind of ethical role they play in our lives. You know, these trees were there before us and they're going to be there after us. And I think there's just a very, at least I have a very emotional connection to that as mm-hmm. well. These trees have witnessed the change of our civilization. The oldest tree I looked at in the process of my dissertation work, it actually dated back to 1774. And it was from pretty close to the house I grew up in. And it turns out that that was from 2 years before the town was founded.
Mm.
And so it's this really neat opportunity to, you know, these trees have witnessed generations of people. Mm-hmm. And so there's also just kind of this emotional and almost religious connection to them, I think, sometimes.
One of the first pictures that I, after I started looking in various magazines for different parts of the world and nature and whatnot, that I was struck by was the redwood forest out in California. And the thing which I thought was interesting, but in retrospect I thought this is a desecration, was that they would take these redwoods, these sequoias, and they would drill out the center and people drive through them. I saw, you know, a picture where they drive, literally they create a little road that goes right through the bottom of the tree. And I thought, you know, that's almost a desecration. That's it.
Almost, but actually, you know, that tree is in all likelihood still alive and doing fine. Because, you know, if you go out into a forest, if you look on the ground, there are going to be branches everywhere. And a lot of trees are hollowed out. You'll see, you know, owls living in them, and the tree will still be alive. Because really, the living part of the tree are those leaves, and then the outer bit of the tree. So you've got the bark, but it's really the inner bark, and then maybe an inch into the tree that's actually alive. Everything else is just structural. It's just left there.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean oh, this is a revelation to me. Do you mean that the center of that tree is dead?
It's dead. I have a colleague that says trees are like people, they're dead inside. He's a bit of a cynic.
I'm going to say a cynic.
But
prosecute a lot of those.
Yeah. but no, only the outer part of the tree is alive. And kind of what determines it being alive is where growth is being put on and then its ability to conduct water. And, you know, most people are aware that trees have rings.
Each
ring is 1 year of growth. And what lets us do so much with that is the fact that kind of once those cells are created, once that ring is formed, it's done. And then kind of, you know, tree growth is almost like an arms race. You have to keep growing up and out to be able to survive and not be crowded out by your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't have energy to support, you know, keep that whole tree that's maybe 3 feet wide alive. And so it's really just that outer ring.
All right. Now you've shattered several illusions that I've had, and I'm going to be very sad tonight that I have to review my whole life in trees. There is, of course, this recently relatively famous book called The Hidden Life of Trees. And as I started reading that, I'm going to read that all the way through now that I've started it. It's very dense. You really have to take care to read this. But it gives you a whole different perspective, not just on the individual trees, but their interrelationship with one another. And I think you've used the word, and I picked up on it, is community. What is this community of trees?
The community of trees are kind of trees in a given area that all interact with each other. You know, kind of what defines your community that you live in, your town.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there's some geographic bound to it, but really the community is the fact that you go to your favorite coffee shop and you get coffee from, you know, Joe the barista, and then you go out and you interact with other people. And so trees do that too. You know, they're interacting with each other, sometimes competition, sometimes, you know, it's, are you going to be able to grow taller than your neighbor to get that job.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's a lot of, and the book goes through this a lot, there's a lot of interaction below ground as well. So again, it's competition, trying to get water or those nutrients. But then there are other ways. you know, oaks have acorns that are great for wildlife. And as squirrels run through the forest getting their acorns, they're also spreading pollen or seeds from other plants. You know, we think about pollinators, bees, butterflies. You know, sometimes the tree, one tree will provide habitat. So it'll have a cavity that that animal will live in. While another one provides its food source, and another provides kind of a good hunting perch for, say, a red-tailed hawk. So it's how these trees interact with each other, but then also the broader ecosystem.
And you're talking not only about just the tree life form, but you're talking about animals, ground animals, bird animals, and frankly, human animals, come to think of it. We looked upon trees back in the day when our foreparents came over here as sources of buildings, or taking them down gave us land to cultivate and with food for food. But we did some pretty awful stuff in Michigan. We had white pines and many pines covering this whole, both the upper and lower peninsula. And I'm speaking now without any expertise, which I'm going to turn over to you and to see if you can help me on this in just a second. But we're going to, after we come back with our break. But we still today have a great reliance on chopping down trees to make homes or buildings. And I used to see these flattened areas and say, oh my God, what a mess. What have we done? And then I read this Hidden Life of Trees, and they're still alive. Those stumps are still growing. Or when they're replanted, they can still grow again. By any rate, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Kristy Rawlinson, who is a tree ecologist, a doctor of trees, at the Morton Arboretum near Chicago. This is John Smetanka, and we're going to be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Kristy Rawlinson, a PhD in tree ecology. And we are talking, we have been talking about trees in their sort of natural community. But then you introduce men, women, chopping trees. And they don't necessarily just walk through the forest to take a look at the beauties and, you know, whatever. But they use them. And I pointed out that in northern Michigan and a good bit of Michigan, we had huge trees, beautiful trees, pine trees, that are were used for furniture wood all over the country. But it comes back. Does it come back in the same form?
Yeah. So pine trees don't do this, but most what we call hardwood trees, so your classic oaks and maples, they will regenerate from their stumps. We call it stump sprouting. And that means that the same tree comes back. Genetically, it's identical. And it's able, and the really advantageous thing about that is that the tree is just regrowing the above ground part. Its roots are still there. So that's part of the reason why forestry can be sustainable, is that if you cut down the forest and then leave it for a while, it will grow back. It just takes a couple decades.
In my the little stretch of land that I own, we have used to have pines. My grandfather planted some Norwegian pines, and so in that process, I watched the birth, the life, and the death of these pine trees. and now it's a completely different kind of mm-hmm. tree, which is dominant. But we have, because we have purposely left the land to fallow, I've watched also when the trees fall over, they are just laying there, and they're getting pretty old. And I just taken the position that that's where God put them, and that's where they're going to stay. Is there a value to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the big differences we think between what, you know, these ancient historical forests or old growth forests and kind of what we see today is that before people came on the landscape, a tree would fall and die, and it would take a very long time. And so there are a couple different roles that plays. One, that gradually recycles nutrients into the forest floor as it decays over the period of sometimes decades. If we're thinking about things from the new carbon market point of view, you know, it's not releasing all of the carbon that was stored in that tree over decades or even centuries back into the atmosphere at once. So it's still providing some money in the bank in terms of carbon. The other thing that I really love with those trees that fall over is sometimes they create what are called nurse logs. So if you've ever been out hiking in a forest and you see it's often a birch tree, and its stem starts about 3 feet off the ground, and it's got these roots that are holding it up, and it creates this like cage-like thing underneath the main stem. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is from when a tree seed landed on that down log. And because it's this really rich decay, the seed is able to germinate and grow really well. And then over, you know, the period of years and decades, that log decays, leaving this happy tree that's propped up.
We few, we happy band of brothers, yeah. What about this thing about, well, if we have more trees, we have less carbon pollution. They eat up carbon, and so our carbon-based automobiles or our industries can, to some extent, rely on those trees to not pollute the air as much as it would. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, because trees are so big and are so long-lived, and because they keep all of, you know, trees grow by taking carbon from the atmosphere and converting it into wood and leaves. Because trees are dead inside, that carbon that they took out, it just stays in that main stem. And so trees cover, I forget the exact numbers. I think it's about 40% of the land area, but account for 60% of the carbon uptake. I could be wrong on those numbers, but the ballpark is right. And so they are responsible for a disproportionate amount of carbon coming out of our atmosphere. And that's because they are so big. And because they are so long-lived, that, you know, carbon in, the trees outside in the parking lot, that center, that's, you know, carbon from 80 years ago. And so a lot of this story, particularly when we think about trees, it has to do with what we do with them, when we choose to cut them down, and what happens to that wood after it's cut down, whether it's left to gradually decay in the forest, or whether it goes to, say, paper, which is often very disposable. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, 50 or 80 years of carbon coming out of the atmosphere goes and makes a piece of paper that when you burn it, in one instance, that carbon is kind of going back out. Whereas if we use that wood to build a house, hopefully that house is going to be there for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, that carbon isn't immediately going back out.
You are now touching on a very sensitive, I can feel this coming. I told you that I love trees. I love walking in the woods. One of the dark, bleak times for me is when the trees are all brown. There's no leaves, and they're just black and brown, and they just stand there. They scrape, although they're beautiful when they're flocked with snow. However, there is a transition period called fall. When I was growing up in the city of Chicago, we had all these trees around, and the leaves would, the colors were beautiful, and the leaves would drop off, and we would rake them up, and then we would burn them. Well, I love the smell of burning leaves. Some of the experiential things. I remember my dad would be raking the leaves when I was a little kid, and he would burn it. The smell just was, it reminded me of my dad, of my family, of growing up when I was free and young and, you know, no responsibility. I'm afraid you're going to tell me that we were rapidly tossing oxygen or carbon back into the atmosphere.
No, it's not that bad, because what would normally happen, you know, particularly in a forest, is all those leaves fall off, mm-hmm. and then they turn into dirt. They turn, or soil, I should say. Mm. And so leaves in particular, you know, they decay quite quickly in a year or two. So there is going to be a lot of that carbon turnover quite quickly already. So it's, you know, it's faster. There's a lot of issues, particularly in the city, with soot, basically particulates in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But in terms of if we're thinking about the global carbon budget, it's not as bad to burn your leaves as it is, say, slash and burn agriculture down in the Amazon, where they are cutting down, you know, 100, 200, or maybe even 1,000-year-old trees and burning them. That is orders of magnitude different.
Okay, I get you. Yeah. Because they have captured this carbon over 1,000 years or 500 years.
Exactly.
And you're immediately burning it into the atmosphere. You are, in fact, throwing up a lot of that stuff.
Exactly. It's not to go too far off topic, but it's a lot of the same thing we talk about when we're talking about fossil fuels, except for that's talking about over millennium instead of just, you know, 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's the same idea. It's the rate at which it takes to create that thing, and then the rate at which it is destroyed, essentially.
You now have about 4 minutes to tell us about global warming and the effect.
Oh, boy.
Can you do that?
Oh, boy. Okay.
Or is that a whole different show?
I mean, there are a couple of things that are, there are lots of different ways to answer that one. Kind of the bottom line, though, is, you know, the climate is warming. The climate is warming rather quickly, particularly when we think about the rate at which it takes a forest to change. You know, we can look over the past 100 or 150 years and see that, you know, this region in particular has warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't seem like a whole lot, but that's talking about on average. And if we think about kind of how that translates into space, it's about the difference between Chicago and Milwaukee. Again, for us, it's like, okay, I can do that in a day. However, if we think about the rate at which trees can migrate, at which their seeds can disperse, you know, an oak tree relies on a squirrel running its nut around mm-hmm. to move. If we think about how far a squirrel moves, it's not very far. It's going to take a squirrel a very long time to kind of on its own randomly wander to Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we think about the fact that a tree needs, say, about 100 years to reach maturity. And so it just takes a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can and we should argue about what role can people do in mitigating climate change or just planning for it. But I think the bottom line is we do need to plan for it and think about what we can do now with how trees grow to make sure our ecosystems are as healthy as they can be in the future.
And that's your job.
Exactly.
And you've accepted it and you love it.
That's why I do this.
All right. Christy Rawlinson, this has been most enjoyable talking to you. I've learned so much, and I got to tell you, it's changed my way of when I walk in the woods. Now I'm going to be looking around for things and seeing those dead trees that really aren't dead. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Christy Rawlinson of the Morton Arboretum in Chicago, and we are constantly now going to be aware of things out there that we just took for granted, and we now know that they are completely community-driven, and just like we are. This is John Smetanka, run with respect. And remember our mantra: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.